Hello,
Hey,
Heather.
Eli.
How are you?
Pretty good. Welcome back to round two.
Yes, round two it is. And hello, Blogging Heads Commentariat.
Hello.
Please make your criticism substantive this time.
Well, right back to where we left off last time with Iran, only even more fun things to argue about in the meantime.
Yes.
Eli has promised to tell us, to reveal for the first time, the full depth of the Cheney-Wormser plan and his personal role in the in preparing for the ground invasion of Iran.
Yes, I'm talking to you live from the New York Sun's Washington Bureau, headquarters of the secret plan to send halfling little people across the border from Iran through underground tunnels built by Palestinian refugees that were kidnapped by Dick Cheney's personal minions. Anyway.
Eli, yeah. I'm sorry, but if you're not talking to us from the super-secret undisclosed bunker, you just have no credibility.
I know, seriously. Anyway, no, there's been quite a bit of chatter in the last month about this, the plans for war, and I've written a little bit about it myself in response to a blog post that got picked up by a professor named Barnett Rubin, and then there's just been a kind of torrent of this stuff. And then I did a story last week where I got a chance to interview David Wormser, who just left the Cheney's office, and he said he did not recognize the conspiracy attributed to Cheney that he shared in a meeting 3 months ago that was written about by a lot of people, including Steve Clemens and recently Newsweek magazine. So anyway, well, let me start with you asking a question like, What's from the kind of liberal left perspective, why can't you just accept that Iran is a threat? You know, that there are going to be a lot of contingency plans right now, and then of course no one is calling for an invasion of that country.
Well, A, I think some people are calling for an invasion of that country, and B, accepting that Iran is a threat is a lot different from calling for an invasion. So I think, you know, everybody, or not everybody, but a lot of people accept that Iran is a threat or a potential threat. A lot of people also, you know, if you believe some of the stuff that's been written and by some of the less liberal commentators around, you know, nobody's accused Steve Clemens of being part of the liberal left last time I checked, that, you know, the general consensus remains.
Well, I'd say Steve Clemens is the liberal left realist alliance in action. And I like, I'm friends with Steve, so I'm not.
Right.
It's not in derision I say that.
I personally would be ecstatic to welcome Steve Clemens to a liberal left that would include both him and me. I think, again, as you did last time, Eli, you've just kind of wiped out the whole middle there, though, if you put it. I don't think Steve wants to be in the liberal. But be that as it may, if you buy the argument that the administration, that the intelligence establishment and that also the Israeli intelligence establishment believe that the actual full-on nuclear threat is about 5 years away, then you ask yourself, well, why are we beating the drums so hard right now? And why are all these plans coming to the fore right now? And for that, I ping-pong the question back to you. Why is it so, and I'd love to hear what Wormser said about this, actually. Why is it so important to these people to beat the drum on this right now? I mean, it's very hard to get away from a very cynical point of view, which just says Iraq is going badly, it's not fun anymore, so we kind of need to move the caravan on. And if we can wrap, as Cy Hirsch describes it, sort of wrap the whole mess in Iraq into the Iran problem and conveniently blame everything that's wrong there on a new external enemy, well, you know, a cynic looks at that and sees the machine of propaganda at work rather than any actual sort of substantive strategic planning. So can you explain to me what they think they're doing?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I don't know anybody who said that we should invade Iran. That's just off the table because of the invasion of Iraq. I mean, I don't know, maybe somebody thinks that there's a secret army somewhere, but that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, what I get a little scared about, Eli, is when I read about these plans, and the first line is always sort of very targeted, super precise, just training camps. And then the next line is, oh, and then we'd have to go back and make sure we got the nuclear infrastructure. And, gee, the nuclear infrastructure would be really hard to get. So then you need special forces ground incursions going along with these supposedly pinprick, carefully calibrated strikes. And when, you know, you've got one special forces ground incursion, then you've got a bunch of them, then you've got a mess you have to clean up, and I just...
Well, I mean, were there special forces ground incursions when Clinton ordered Operation Desert Fox?
I do not actually know. Well, I have to say, when Clinton...
It's a whole lot different, I'm just saying, than Operation Iraqi Freedom, right? I mean...
Right, but
that's two different things.
Yeah, but these guys have zero credibility, I mean, with me and more importantly with anybody else,
right.
that they could act, that they could or that they want to conduct something that's really as limited as, you know, what you suggest when you start talking
about
super limited.
I mean, first of all, I think that there's a lot of plans that are contingency plans right now. That's the first thing. So, I mean, and the people who would leak partial plans, I mean, I checked out a lot of what Cy Hirsch wrote, and it's true that there are plans being drawn up to hit Iranian terrorist training camps. Now, one person who I talked to in the administration yesterday about that said that one possibility would be, you know, let's look at this a couple ways. First of all, why are you going to be bombing Iran? Okay, now, there are some people, I think, more outside the administration who think that aerial bombardment somehow gets you, you know, I don't know, causes so much shock and awe that there's a regime change. I think, and I've written this a couple times, that's ridiculous. An aerial bombardment actually will probably, you know, set back the best chance of regime change, which would be the internal democratic opposition forces in Iran, insofar as it would give, I mean, not like the Iranians need much of a pretext, and not like they haven't been horrible to their opposition already, but it would probably get worse. Now, the second thing, which is, I think, a more serious objection to the bombing, and then I want to kind of get into different reasons as to why you – well, let me go through the different kinds of bombing. Then there's a counterterrorism mission for the bombing, which is that there are not only terrorist training camps, but there are also these IED/EFP factories that the Pentagon talks about. We know their locations, and, you know, presumably it would be a good thing if you kind of got rid of some of that infrastructure. Again, that's very easily replaced. So, you know, you may get some short-term breathing space, but it also may, if you just did that and you didn't hit the nuclear infrastructure, then the real concern, and finally, of course, there's a counterproliferation bombing, which would be that you would try to disrupt as much as what we knew about in the Iranian program. And people would say, well, maybe you couldn't get all of it because we don't know all of it. And it's true that the Iranians have not shared all of the relevant information about the history of their nuclear program with the IAEA after all of this time. But I think we know enough of it, and I think that Natanz, because we know a lot about Natanz, I mean, foreign diplomats have been, escorted through at Natanz by Iranian leaders, and we know that they're building lots of cascades there, that it would probably be a setback, at least, if we got that and Bushehr and a few of the other places that are known. So those are the three reasons why you would bomb Iran. Regime change is a fallacy. Counterterrorism is probably not as much of a benefit. And then there's the potential for counterproliferation. And then, anyway, the serious issue, or is it sort of to talk about this seriously, is that, you know, when I talk to administration officials and military folks now, what they tell me is they actually don't think that Iran is at a full 10 in Iraq. There are probably, people say, if I ask them on a scale of 1 to 10, what is it? People will say a 5, usually. Sometimes people will say like a 7. Which is to say that you would expect a serious repercussion, political and military, and, you know, kind of in terms of more terrorism in Iraq. Not to mention, you know, and this isn't me, this is McConnell and a lot of other people and have written about this, you know, that there is a suspicion that there are Hezbollah sleeper cells even in America, certainly in the Western Hemisphere, not to mention Gaza, not to mention Lebanon. So the Iranians have, from just a kind of non-conventional perspective, a lot of ways that they can then retaliate to a bombing campaign, and it's hard to imagine that even a massive bombing campaign would knock out their ability to do that sort of stuff. So that, I think, is a serious argument against it, and one that I think is primarily prevailed in the administration, contrary to a lot of the stories that we've seen at this point, suggesting that it's like all but certain that this stuff, and by the way, we've seen that like the bombing campaign or some sort of starting a war with Iran will, you know, is all but inevitable. So that's my understanding of sort of the state of play. But yet, you know, the Bush is never going to say, and Condoleezza Rice is never going to say, you know, we would never bomb Iran, because they believe that is a legitimate trigger, or rather incentive, to get the Iranians to comply with, you know, the IAEA, not to mention comply with, you know, basic sort of commitments that they may have made over the years with regards to Iraq, not to mention not being a sponsor of terrorism. So there's a whole series of legitimate complaints we have with the Iranians. And holding out the threat of bombing them, at least, and maybe trying to make them paranoid in that respect, is considered, I think, I mean, it's hard to argue that, like, why would you take that off the table if at this point they're being so defiant?
So, Eli, I want to back up here. I think you laid out really nicely one of the cases for why bombing Iran is a dumb idea at this juncture, and that's great, and I don't have to do it, and I agree with everything you said and would add more, but I don't think I need to.
Yeah.
So then you're telling me that some chunk of the administration that basically agrees with the case you've just laid out.
Well, the relevant chunk of the administration, i.e. the president, the National Security Council, the people making decisions, agree. And believe it or not, like, Vice President Cheney doesn't have Bush's brain in a vat at the basement of the American Enterprise Institute. That's not true. I checked it out.
They released it a few months ago.
Yeah.
So then why... I mean, look, there are always contingency plans being made for all kinds of things that we would all find very upsetting if we read about them in The New Yorker. I agree with you on that, and I even agree that, in fact, that's one of the things that you have a government bureaucracy to do, is think through that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So then the question becomes, why are there so many new plans being made right now? Why is it going beyond the kind of contingency planning that everybody who's done it knows is just scenario planning, to the kind of, let's try to get more chunks of the armed forces on board with this, let's change the way the planning is done to bring in the Navy because we know the Navy will be supportive because they're being left out of all the fun in Iraq and itchy to do something? Why do you have the public opinion press? Why do you have Kyle Lieberman? The only reason that you need Kyle Lieberman is to try to put the Democrats in a vice so that they can't block you when you want to do something. So if you really, truly don't want to do anything, why are you pursuing this stuff?
Well, I mean, a couple things, okay? And then I would like to get to a criticism of the sort of we're about to have war literature. But Kyle Lieberman is pretty clear. I mean, listen, right now, you mentioned the five-year estimates. I mean, everybody always says 5 years for the Iranian nuclear program, and then they get a bomb. And plus, I've heard that actually has changed, contrary to the Cy Hirsch piece, which is to say that the intelligence community has recently come up with a new calculation, which is less than 5 years. And why is that? Well, it's because they're brazenly enriching uranium. They announced at one point that they'd mastered the fuel cycle. We don't think they did when they announced that a year and a half ago, I guess. But in fact, you know, every day they're closer. There is no linear progression, as you know, to when you get a nuclear program. So,
Which means, by the way, that it's not necessarily true that every day they're closer. Some days they're further away and some days they're closer.
Fair enough. But I'm just saying that as they tinker and they try, and the more trial and error, once they master certain technology, it doesn't become like, well, then it's going to take the same amount of time before they get something. I mean, I think in many ways, like, it's not a good, you know, these intelligence community estimates are, I mean, I don't take them seriously, whether they're from Israel, Europe, or wherever. I mean, they're just sort of, you know, that it's a guess. And but the reality remains that they are enriching uranium. They're getting closer to figuring out the hardest part of how to make a nuclear weapon. They're in violation of now two Chapter 7 resolutions of the UN Security Council, and despite like kind of a pivot at one point in August from Mohammed al-Baradei, it now seems that, you know, even Ban Ki-moon is saying, you know, they have to stop enriching uranium. So Kyle Lieberman can be explained that in the middle of the negotiations that went on in New York this last month and are continuing to go on, there is a kind of, you know, one of the big sticks that the State Department is hoping to kind of wield, at least over the Germans, who still do quite a bit of investment in the Iranian economy, is to say, listen, if you want to kind of continue to be in the Russia-China camp on this issue in terms of the sanctions and not join our, you know, British-French-American access and Japanese access, then, you know, we can really make your life miserable by declaring the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. And that means that, you know, Deutsche Bank and Commerce Bank and all these banks that, you know, are German entities, you know, that have any potential dealings, even indirectly, with the Revolutionary Guard, would then, you know, potentially be in a lot of international legal trouble, not to mention trouble with our own financial system.
Eli, if that had been the main purpose of the resolution, I would find that a convincing argument. But the main purpose of the resolution was to create something Gulf of Tonkin-like, which obscurely and indirectly appeared to give the president authority to do whatever he wanted militarily inside Iran.
I know that's what the blogosphere said. I don't think that that's what it said, though. It didn't say that. It specifically said – it listed all the bad things that Iran was doing, which I don't think are – you know, at least let me put it like this. When it listed all of the particulars and terribles of the Iranians, they quoted the testimony of Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus. Now, I guess there is the move-on contingent that thinks that he's just a liar, but –
Eli, you're reading the wrong part of the resolution, though. You're committing the classic fallacy of reading the descriptive stuff rather than the actionable stuff, and the actionable stuff listed off a variety of means that the president was authorized to use inside Iran, and one of them was military.
Well, it didn't. It said it limited the action, I'm pretty sure, and I don't have it in front of me, but it limited it to specifically actions within Iraq. I think that there was an earlier resolution that was unclear
paragraphs. Paragraph 3 is within Iraq, and paragraph 4 is the one that appeared to give broader justification. And I can pull it up on my computer, but technically I have to say I'm a little bit afraid that if I do that, I'll crash the whole thing.
Yeah, I know. I'm afraid too. Okay.
So our viewers can go out and look this up for yourselves. How's that? Rather than Eli,
I continue. And I also thought that Levin or Reed at the end or somebody kind of got that stuff out of it.
Yes, they did. But my point is Kyle and Lieberman don't get any credit for not wanting to put that stuff in it. So when you talk about what the original purposes of the resolution was, as far as I'm concerned, that paragraph was the original purpose, and it was A, to sneakily get authorization for military force, and B, to squeeze and embarrass the Democrats.
I think it said, it was very vague in how it was is written.
Oh, exactly. But that's exactly the point.
I think the point of it was actually just to pressure the State Department. There's two views on this, right? The president did, and I was actually, by the way, the first to write about the Revolutionary Guard being designated as a foreign terrorist entity. Okay, this was back in July. The president kind of agreed to it. And then it was scuttled for a while because the State Department, I think correctly, said, listen, we could use this as serious leverage in our negotiations with the Europeans, because nobody thinks they're going to get the kind of sanctions they want from the UN. So they're going to go for this kind of coalition of the willing sanctions. And then in turn, that, you know, there are people now like Kyle Lieberman. I think Lieberman and Senator Kyle and others on the Hill really want the president to just go ahead and list the Iranians as a terrorist entity. But I think it was all about that. And I think the other stuff was just kind of window dressing. And I'm, you know, regardless, they agreed that it would be kind of pulled out of it. They made clear in the floor speeches that, you know, this has got nothing to do with authorizing any kind of military action against Iran. So while, you know, I'm not disagreeing with you that there was probably an earlier draft. In fact, I know there was because I saw it, that may have sort of been specifically vague on actions within Iran. I don't think that the reason for the resolution was that. I think it was mainly to pressure to either make the resolution, and then the argument that ultimately kind of prevailed with Democrats like Hillary Clinton was that it was a great way to pressure in these really sensitive negotiations, which, by the way, viewers, if you don't want to bomb Iran, then the best chance we have is to have, you know, is for this kind of sanction and coercive diplomacy to work. I mean, it seems to me that, if you want to avoid a scenario where we have to take out the nuclear program and risk a counterterrorism strike and all this other stuff, which I think everybody would, then, let's hope that the negotiations with our European allies and others work, right?
Eli, you're just wrong about the purpose of the resolution.
Right,
I'm sorry.
I think you're wrong.
You know, I think in a better world, you would have had a resolution that was just trying to do what you're saying. But
yeah.
And I thought it was excellent maneuvering on the part of congressional Democrats to end up with a resolution that only does the things we've been discussing and doesn't do what were paragraphs 3 and 4 of the original. And then to get into a position where Democrats were able to vote their consciences and their concerns on it and come out, I think, pretty clean. And I thought that showed you a lot more smartness about maneuvering on these issues than you would have had a couple years ago. Second, on the whole question of how do you apply effective pressure in negotiating, and there's two strategies. And one you've referred to, and it's the kind of, I am a crazy person, I am at least as crazy as you, if not crazier, and you cannot count on that at any moment I may not decide to do something really crazy. And that's clearly the strategy that Ahmadinejad is using on us. And I'm a little dubious about the utility of our using it back on him. So I think you have a line to walk where, on the one hand, you know, no, I don't think it would be particularly useful to say, gosh, we would never, ever consider doing any harm to the Iranian government, no matter what it did. That's clearly not a useful negotiating strategy.
Obviously, yes.
But it's also not useful to bang the war drums so much that the Iranians get the impression that nothing they do makes any difference. If you're going to try to play that game, you need to do it in a pretty coherent and structured way. And, you know, frankly,
we didn't bang the war drums. I mean, I remember a year and a half ago, Condoleezza Rice got up and gave a conference saying, listen, we'll sit down, talk about everything with the Iranians if they just stop enriching uranium and agree to this generous package that the Europeans have put forward. There was originally, after 2003, on at least the nuclear side with the Iranians, an understanding that you know, there was going to be, we weren't going to put you into double jeopardy with the UN Security Council. We're going to give you a chance to kind of come clean with the IAEA. And in the interim, we were going to work out something where if you really wanted nuclear power, we were going to make sure you had it, but you couldn't, you know, have the capacity to potentially break out as North Korea had with a nuclear weapons program. That's A. And then B, I mean, as for Iraq, with the Iranians, there was a policy for a very long time until about a year ago that where we said, you know, we expect that you, you know, like you've said, have an interest in a stable Iraq. And we empowered the parties that were at one point their proxies that they helped train as the new government that replaced Saddam Hussein. And yes, there has been an uneasy sort of relation, but it hasn't been all banging war drums. I mean, there's been Zalmay Khalilzad has had numerous meetings with Iranians over the years, whether he was in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now, you know, in the UN. So,
well, in fact, there's a steady track of negotiations going on in Baghdad that actually a friend of mine is running, as I recall with astonishment every time I get up in my nice, safe suburban house in the morning. The problem that was, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase that someone once had, which was that the problem you have in this whole thing is that both sides are beset by so many conflicting rationales and conflicting internal issues, so that sort of one day you have Secretary Rice going out and saying, look, these are the carrots and these are the sticks we're going to lay out for you in a very rational way. This is the path forward. And then 2 weeks later, another administration official gets up and says, basically, there's nothing the Iranians could ever do that would satisfy us, and the negotiating track is dead. And so then if you're the Iranians, you kind of scratch your head about how to interpret that. We, on the other hand, face the Iranians one day coming to the table saying, okay, we'll work with El Baradei now. And then the next week you have, you know, Ahmadinejad getting up and saying, well, you know, the existence of the State of Israel is a regrettable error, and the facts of the Holocaust still need to be determined. And, oh, by the way, this is all about our self-defense, and there's nothing to discuss. And so then, you know, understandably, any administration would kind of throw up its hands and say, look, are these people crazy or not, as you and I discussed on our previous call. But the answer to that is not for us to be less consistent and less rational than they are. And we, you know, in part because of all this infighting with the administration and the question of, you know, which basement the president's brain is in a jar, or however you want to put it, in a less flip way than that, but you know, an outsider, even a well-meaning, sane, rational outsider who's thinking in the same tropes that we're thinking in, could look at the administration and be a little uncertain about where the center of decision-making power lies on this issue. Much less the Iranians who, you know, even if you adopt the rational actor model, there's still a tremendous power struggle going on there. Ahmadinejad is still dependent on this for his domestic sources of power, really, so that people don't pay attention to how crummy things are inside the country. And so let's just say we're not ideally situated to have a successful negotiating process. And, you know, to go back around to what I said at the beginning, stuff like this Kyle Lieberman, which may have had one legitimate, useful purpose vis-a-vis designating the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization, also had domestic political purposes here. But then that gets read in Tehran, and they say, okay, well, you know, the same as every commentator writing an article this week that we started out talking about this, does this really mean they're planning to attack us or not, and how do we respond? So you create a lot of chaff that makes this harder, and I think the administration,
I don't see how the Iranian behavior is comparable, and I'm very wary of people talking about the various, I mean, it's true that Ahmadinejad as the president is not the same power as the American president. Though I seem to remember when Khatami was the president, nobody seemed to make that argument when they were talking about sort of modes of engagement. But like,
oh, I was in the administration trying to figure out modes of engagement, and that argument was, if not made, it was something that we were painfully aware of. But no, you're right that it's wrong to draw a one-for-one correspondent.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I acknowledge that, but I'm just saying that, like, okay, the alternative would be Hashemi Rafsanjani, you know, who played an interesting role in the Iran-Contra affair, who is the father of the Iranian nuclear program, who said in 2001 that, you know, Iran could survive a nuclear engagement with Israel and it would be good because they would wipe out all the Jews. Now, I mean, was he saying that for domestic consumption? I don't know, but is this your moderate? I'm just saying, I mean, I don't really think that it's possible to be a moderate or to be anybody who we would like to see in Iran, as a point I've made on other dialogues, which is to say that all of the reformers were crushed for the most part by the mullah hardliners themselves. So, yeah, we have a choice between the millenarian Holocaust-denying Ahmadinejad and the limited nuclear exchange Rafsanjani and an ailing supreme leader. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, I think we shouldn't pretend that there's a pony in that leadership, so to speak.
But it is true
that there are different modes of power, and I think that there is a sound argument that at a certain point it's possible that if you really put the squeeze on the Iranian financial system, if you put the squeeze in other respects, then you would have pressure saying, okay, you know, listen, it's just not worth it to kind of keep going down this path, or maybe not, but I would just say that the Iranians, regardless of Ahmadinejad's statements, let's just table that, have been brazen in their actions and defiant in their actions. And at a certain point, we have to ask ourselves, again, what's the credibility of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty at this point? If you can sort of be in compliance or think you're in compliance or obviously not be in compliance but have nothing happen up to the brink where you get a nuclear weapon, that defeats the whole purpose of why we have the treaty and the Atoms for Peace program. We're going to exchange technology to make sure you don't use it to build nukes, and we're going to have all this transparency. It's an important part of the international system, it seems, and the Iranians just have no interest in kind of abiding by their rules, and it really does raise this important question, because I don't want this regime getting a nuclear weapon. I mean, I would hope that everyone would agree with that. Like, it would be really bad if they got a nuclear weapon, right?
I love it when neocons start to talk about protecting rules in the international system, and I think this might be a good point for us to transition. I mean, in my mind, it's a logical transition to Rudy Giuliani so that we don't talk about Iran the whole hour. There are several significant blows to the nuclear nonproliferation regime that made what Iran is now doing possible. And they have to do with India and Pakistan and some other states, which have become nuclear powers with little or no penalty from anybody. And so you're totally right that any Iranian leader, no matter who it is, no matter how supposedly moderate they are, no matter how much we want to hug them in New York City, is going to look around and say, look, we're a great power with a 1,000-year history of greatness, and those people over the mountains to the east of us have nuclear weapons, and the West is going to tell us they can't. And, oh, by the way, there's that stuff in the NPT about disarmament, and the U.S. is building new kinds of nuclear weapons, and they're going to tell us we can't have any. So, yeah, that is – the credibility issue is a fundamental issue that we have no matter who is the head of Iran or, for that matter, other countries that are looking at nuclear weapons too. And it's a problem that we, unfortunately, have some complicity in.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying, but if the Iranian president was Akbar Ghanji – then I really wouldn't be like a first order concern for me. So happens that the Iranian president is a mod in a nutbag. So I mean,
right. But again, to go back,
and you know, Ali Khamenei is the supreme leader. You know, I just want to, if we could just take a very brief time, and what was your thoughts on Bollinger? And I know it was last week, but I just...
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing because, you know, Bollinger came from Ann Arbor to Columbia, so there was a great sort of feeling here of sort of watching how he does on the global stage. And I think two things. And one is just in terms of the state of American civilization, I thought it was very sad. You know, I think it's fine to invite somebody to speak and then let them speak and then cream them any way you want and comment back to them any way you want. I thought it was on the one hand very sad that he felt the need to do this before the guy even opened his mouth. On the other hand, I thought it was a brilliant political maneuver. And instead of the next day having headlines, you know, howling for his head as president of Colombia, you had, you know, AIPAC mailing out his speech as a great example of defense of, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So from his point of view, I think it was an absolutely brilliant move. The fact that it was a brilliant move, and he felt it necessary to do it, I think, says something really sad about the state of discourse in America.
Wow. I don't think that there's any reason that you should discourse with Ahmadinejad insofar as that he really represents the negation of free speech and discourse insofar as, you know, his sort of geopolitical agenda and his domestic political agenda. I love the Bollinger speech. I loved it so much that I'm going to start referring to really eloquent arguments that just tear someone apart from limb to limb as a Bollinger. Like if you break up with your girlfriend and you mention like every flaw, I just gave her the Bollinger. you know, that's something like that. Anyway, I thought...
I have to say, Eli, that comment right there, I mean, that kind of, to me, underlines my point that it was brilliant maneuvering, but it's also kind of about the death of American civilization.
No, it's not about the... It's the greatness of American civilization. There's no particular reason why. I mean, like, I would have... If I was the president of Columbia, I would have said, sure, you can speak on my campus. You just have to wear an orange jumpsuit and ankle bracelets. I mean, this guy... Listen, why is... It's not a free speech issue. We get to hear this lunatic all the time. You can read many of his crazy speeches wherever you want. He is not in need of a microphone. This is not a voice that, you know, Columbia students couldn't get on their own. And why would you honor somebody like this? And it's not just because he's a denier of the Holocaust. It's not just because he's, you know, said he wants to wipe Israel off the map. It's not just because of all this other stuff. I mean, it's the fact of the matter is that, I mean, this kind of gets into this, like, Juan Cole piece, which, you know, we're not going to spend a lot of time on. But, I mean, I think that there are some people who are really practicing what is kind of like an obscurantism. It's not that, like, the neocons and the right-wing media want to turn this into a big deal. I mean, he has already done so many things that are offensive to our very values. So if you care about American discourse and those sorts of things, then you sort of have to be against Ahmadinejad, and at least for his abject humiliation, I think.
Well, but I actually think that, in fact, that speech that he gave and the response to it has actually done a rather good job of making lots of Americans who weren't aware of what the problem with him is more aware. I mean, how else would he have ever ended up on Saturday Night Live?
Agreed. And that's the other thing. I sent you that. I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was better than anything Karen Hughes has ever done. But I'm not a big Karen Hughes fan, so.
No, you said it to me, this, for folks who haven't seen it, and we'll put up the link afterward, is this Saturday Night Live spoof. For those of you who are old enough to remember the Flock of Seagulls song, "And I Ran." And it's basically a love song to Ahmadinejad, and it's quite funny. And as I say, it will have been seen by a whole new audience who, you know, had no idea that Iran had a president who hates homosexuals and Jews and everybody else. So, you know, in terms of putting Ahmadinejad on sale in what passes for the market ideas and finding him lacking, you know, that's a result that you couldn't have had without giving him a platform in the United States of America.
Right. I actually was wrong. I mean, I didn't write anything specifically. I went on a cable news show and it was asked about this, and I said I didn't think it was good to invite him. But in retrospect, I mean, there are two things. I think that video plus him being laughed at for that crazy comment on homosexuals and the Bollinger speech will make it, and they already are making it into the Persian opposition websites. So there's going to be a viral effect in Iran.
And that's what freedom of speech is about, by the way.
What?
Freedom of speech is also about the freedom to make yourself into an idiot on national
Absolutely.
TV.
So I think that is a good – that's a very good thing to sort of see for Iranians themselves, to sort of see their president in his full idiocy. And then, you know, sort of the subject of a love song by two Jews, no less. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. Anyway, I'd like to just thank Saturday Night Live, effete liberal Bush haters that you are, for striking a blow for freedom.
But, you know, I mean, that's the whole point, that you could be an effete liberal Bush hater and also hate, you know, extremism, fanaticism, terror. You know, you don't have to love George Bush to
absolutely.
Hate those things.
No, absolutely. No. And that actually is, it goes without saying. So.
Yeah. And you asked me, actually, this is a more serious point. But when you sent me that video clip, you nominated it for one of the top three pieces of public diplomacy since 9/11. And I wanted to make my own nominations, none of which, unfortunately, is funny. I mean, all of which are
okay,
actually...
Okay, what are your...
So my top three are actually U.S. assistance post-tsunami.
Okay, yeah.
Which was very public, very visible, and really had a measurable impact in changing at least Indonesian public opinion of the U.S. Number two would be the attacks in London and Madrid that killed a lot of Muslims.
Absolutely.
And that it was very clear to every. Oh, and Bali, I should add also, that just killed a lot
and
of ordinary.
And also Oman. I was actually in Oman in
the
aftermath, and that was amazing. Even in Zarqawi's hometown, actually, in Zarqa, they hated him after that, yeah.
Yep. And I have to say my third thing would be the 2006 congressional elections. Mostly, that one more so in Europe, I think, than in the Muslim world. But the incredible outpouring of, oh, my gosh, the Americans aren't quite as hopeless about these people as we thought they were. So that, I mean, what to me is sobering about all of those things is that none of them are things that Karen Hughes had any control over. And now I agree with you that, you know, Karen Hughes was the wrong person for that job. She hasn't made much effort to learn what she could have learned from the folks around her. The stuff they've done has been downright embarrassing. But, you know, fundamentally they're saddled with, A, a tiny apparatus that doesn't really know how to use modern media, and, B, a set of crummy policies that you can't put lipstick on.
Well, I don't think that... I think you got into something, actually, that's interesting that I've thought for a long time, which is that it's public diplomacy is probably something that we can do little to control as much as we... or at least we think we can control. And what's more important in terms of public diplomacy is, A, actual foreign policy, as you pointed out, but also the... let's never forget the blunders of, you know, our hateful and fanatical enemies. And, you know, just to sort of see bin Laden and Zawahiri and the late Zarqawis, you know, sort of words for themselves, I think most Muslims, as someone who's lived for a year in Cairo, you know, once they kind of come face-to-face with this sort of stuff, yes, there are a group of losers and sort of marginal types who will be attracted to that, but their majority of people will sort of be very threatened by it. So don't count out the ability of our enemies to make their own worst case.
Yeah, which brings up another point about the way we conceptualize public diplomacy, and this is a case place where, frankly, you would have expected a Republican administration to get this and do a better job with it. Mm-hmm. But the whole construct is designed for a world 40 or 50 years ago where there wasn't globalized consumerism, there wasn't globalized media, there wasn't globalized advertising. And, you know, the amount that the U.S. government spends on public diplomacy for everything is, you know, probably less than Coke spends on one global ad campaign. And it's just, it's the government has no longer got a monopoly on images of the U.S. around the world. So then the question becomes not sort of how does the government do public diplomacy, but how does the government look at what's already out there and try to fill in gaps and provide additional perspectives and sort of make key targeted interventions and otherwise, you know, sort of observe what's happening in the private and nonprofit sectors, work with it maybe sometimes, try to counteract it other times, you know, like Baywatch effect or whatever. But the whole notion that the government can kind of do public diplomacy for the U.S. is really, you know, at least 10 years and maybe more like 20 years outdated. And you actually have coalitions of private business saying, hey, wait a second, actually, we can do this much better than government ever could. And on this, I'm a real small government conservative because I think they're right.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, my view of it is do what you can. I mean, we're not going to agree on Iraq, and this is not actually what we were scheduled. Let's move on to Hillary and Giuliani. But just as a last point, I think it's more important to leave Iraq better than we found it than all the public diplomacy in the world. And I also think that it's not just Karen Hughes. I mean, the State Department hasn't done any good public diplomacy since 9/11, as far as I'm concerned. Remember those, like, you know, we have Muslims in America too commercials? Anyway, which we do. All right, so what do you want to start with, Hillary or Rudy?
Well, I want to start with Rudy because one of the things that I do find so strange about Rudy's approach to the world is that you have this kind of weird mix of what you might call old-line traditional Republican internationalism. So you have all this stuff in his foreign affairs piece about we have to strengthen the international system. But then I can't discern what he thinks the international system is because, you know, he clearly doesn't think it's the UN. He seems to be one of those, you know, NATO should do everything and we should expand it all the way through the Middle East people, which, you know, tells me that he hasn't actually spent much time at NATO meetings. But he has, as you know, he has Norman Podritz and everybody else advising him, but I have yet to kind of really feel like I've put my finger on what his worldview actually is.
Well, Rudy Giuliani has pointed out, I think, what, you know, I think what your side should admit, too, which is that there are certain real failings right now of the UN in particular. I actually have this here because he says in the foreign affairs piece, if I can quote it, you know, finally, we need to look realistically at America's relationship with the United Nations. The organization can be useful for some humanitarian and peacekeeping functions, but we should not expect much more of it. And that position is not blow up the United Nations. In fact, I mean, I can say a friend of mine who's who I don't want to say his name, but we were joking about this recently, and he said that Rudy would at some point at the UN General Assembly give the cardboard box speech, in which he said, all of you will find a cardboard box in front of you. Please put your things in it and vacate
right.
The premises by Friday. Right, you know, we are now putting this space on Turtle Bay available on the Tel Aviv and Taipei Craigslist. But that's a joke. Anyway, but what he's saying, I think, is that the notion that we got in sort of the original opposition to the Iraq War, that, you know, the U.S. should never buck the U.N. Security Council. And the U.N.'s, and I think Beinart, actually, in his apologetics and his apology book, kind of gets into this idea that, like, you know, when other great nations say we shouldn't do a war, then we should listen to them. But what he's saying is that, actually, you know what, the U.N. has not done a very good job in before the Iraq War of preventing wars, and it's also not done a good job on the key issues of our time, which would be proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. And on terrorism, the UN can't seem to get a consensus. And I think that where he's going with this, though he doesn't come out and quite say it, is that the reason is because you've got kind of, you know, terror regimes like the Iranians in the international system, and it's really creating a problem, which is that, you know, how do you deal with somebody that defiant? I mean, what would it mean to have an agreement with the Iranians about terrorism, considering they've built their armed forces on the notion that they're going to use terrorism as a means of their statecraft? I mean,
well, since we're the ones who helped block a UN agreement on terrorism shortly after 9/11, or, you know, who pushed very hard for it and then walked away from it and stopped paying attention, you know, it's hard to know.
I don't know if it's because what I'm saying is that if once you get everything watered down, the UN doesn't have very good enforcement mechanisms, and there are serious problems in that there are when you have nation states that sponsor terrorism, and you also have nation states that are, you know, brazenly, like North Korea and Iran, building these weapons of mass destruction, and the UN has sort of proved incapable of doing anything about it, then what he's saying is, listen, we might have to rely on parallel institutions to keep the peace and security, and the U.S. should lead those institutions and then count on the UN. And he says, you know, they can do a good job on peacekeeping and humanitarian aid, you know, on these other important issues, you know, they've kind of had their shot and it doesn't look like they've done a very good job.
But Eli, when have they actually, I mean, there's two things. One is, I don't want to spend a lot of time, the UN is a deeply imperfect institution.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of two tracks of UN problems.
Yeah.
And one is the institutional problems, that the UN is a deeply flawed place. There's an institutional bureaucratic culture that is not everything it should be. There have been a lot of efforts at reform and progress has been made, but a lot more needs to be done. So that, you know, the kind of the stuff you saw around oil for food, for example, some of the more unpleasant peacekeeper scandals that reflect a real culture of impunity.
All of the wasted aid to the Palestinian Authority.
Those are problems that are, you know, that you can sort of say, okay, those are the UN's fault. Although, mind you, they are also problems that exist in national aid bureaucracies. They exist in corporations. You know, this idea that somehow the UN is more corrupt than the rest of us, I just don't buy. But there's a second track of problems that somebody like Rudy Giuliani is really talking about when he's saying what's wrong with the UN. And, okay, now why is the non-proliferation regime is a great example. Why has it lost so much credibility in recent years? Well, I think I have to say that goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about how it came about that there was this whole crop of new nuclear states that nobody said boo about. And you can't really point to
I believe that happened under another president.
You have to point to the member states. Well, some of the states that became nuclear happened before Bill Clinton got into office, as you may recall.
True.
So, you know, so that is one where, yes, the UN regime has not prevented more nuclear states from emerging. But member states, including the U.S. under both parties' leadership and other great powers, have not really been very interested in having the UN be effective. And, you know, frankly, similarly on terrorism, the U.S. in some ways was not very interested in getting a U.N. terrorism convention because we perceived it would be a check on our activities, and maybe we were even right about that. But you can't, on the one hand, say, oh, we don't want the U.N. to do things because it will check us, and on the other hand, oh, the U.N. can't do anything. So, you know, I have no problem with, we can't expect the U.N. to solve all our problems. You know, that's a perfectly fine, small-R realist bit of, you know. But I think actually everybody, you know, with the possible exception of Denis Kucinich, there's no one running for president who really thinks the U.N. can solve all our problems. But what you find, if you think the international system is important, if you think that there being norms and constraints on state behavior is important, if you spend all your time rhetorically beating down the administrations that provide norms and constraints and legitimacy to, you know, get support from far-right primary voters, then you can't really be very surprised when those institutions don't work well because you've been instrumental in depriving them of legitimacy.
Ah, okay. Now, let me if I could sum up, I think your point here is that for the UN to work, America needs to take it more seriously. Is that what you're saying? Like, it has to lead it, you know, and really take the constraints of the UN seriously and submit itself as the most powerful nation in the world under the UN as an example for all the other nations in the hopes that all the other nations will follow. Is that correct?
Until you got to the in the hopes part, which, you know, makes it sound sort of naive and hand-holding, that you need to take a very pragmatic approach to the UN and say, okay, here we can give up something to get something.
Okay.
Here we can give up all day and never get anything.
Right.
But there's a, you know, there's a kind of sadder but wiser approach to the UN, and then there's a sadder and go-to-hell approach to the
UN.
Okay,
well, I mean, and I just, if I could just make a sort of side point here, you know, and there never is any recognition about, you know, when there's an earthquake in India, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters? No, you call the U.S. Navy. And we deliver, you know, we are providing a lot of the load and lift capability for a lot of the kind of really good humanitarian works that the UN does do. I always thought that it would be nice if the UN General Assembly could every now and again just have a Thanks America resolution. But that's not going to happen. I understand it.
Yeah, come on. We live in, I mean, I would like to be thanked for every diaper I change,
too. No, I'm just saying, Heather, you know, we do a lot that, like, everyone never gives us credit for, because it's popular to you know, and it's understandable that the top dog is always going to be resented. But the other thing I would say is that I think what Rudy's getting at, and a lot of neoconservatives are worried about, is the kind of, you know, sovereign equality is a good idea in a lot of respects, insofar as, you know, it stopped a lot of the chaos of, I guess, after the Treaty of Westphalia. But the problem is that when you've got states that really are rogues, and we're not talking about states just that we don't like, but I think we could say Burma, Zimbabwe, Sudan, and then Iran, obviously, and North Korea, and there are others, that are perpetual international lawbreakers. And it's not just on the biggies like terrorism and proliferation. It's like pretty much on everything. And they've shown no interest in abiding by international law. I mean, I can – this is an interesting example that would go back to the 90s. But do you remember when the Sudanese and al-Qaeda helped, you know, tried at one point to assassinate Hosni Mubarak? One of the things that in the UN investigation of that they found was that the Sudanese at the time under Tarabi were using their diplomatic missions in order to help escort terrorists to, you know, kind of, you know, pull off these operations. So if you've got a state that is willing to use its kind of diplomatic immunity in such a way to forward things that destroy and or are aimed at, that in some ways sort of undermine the entire international system, there has to be some mechanism for second or third class international citizenship. And I think that's really where Rudy is going, but he's not going to put it out that explicitly. And I think he also wants to leave open the door because he thinks that, you know, we don't know. Ban Ki-moon may be the most brilliant UN Secretary General we've ever seen. And, you know, you could see a lot of certain changes. But I think that, you know, the sorts of things that Rudy's concerned about is, like, for example, in Darfur. The main obstacle diplomatically for having done anything yet in Darfur is largely the Chinese, because they have this veto. And why do the Chinese, I mean, seem to protect the worst human rights abusers on the planet, and why should that stop, you know, the civilized world or the rest of the West? I'm trying to say civilized world. China's, you know, is the center of civilization. But why should that stop the West from acting to prevent these kind of atrocities? So that's the sort of frustration there. Now, you're right that in the far right, you know, reaches of the Republican Party, there is a traditional kind of paleoconservative concern about giving up any American sovereignty to any global organization, the black helicopters crowd. But that's not, I think, Rudy, and I don't think that's me. I know it's not me. I'm saying it's not a lot of people right now who, you know, I think that the issue is like, yeah, we would love an international system. It's just the international system, for it to work, should have people, member states in the international, committed to that, to actually sort of being a part of it on a very basic level. And there's certain states that really, I think, have proven time and again that they're not. Right.
So, Eli, just to go back and take that one piece at a time, and the first thing I want to tell our readers is that you just raised a very interesting point about second or third class citizenship and what that would look like, which I have to say, I don't see that anywhere in the text of that Giuliani article.
Well,
so
I said it wasn't in there.
I don't think that's in there. Rudy.
I don't think he explicitly,
I think that's
but my
Eli,
sense is that that's kind of where it's going. Is what
right,
I'm
right. No, I just want to, I wanted to point out to the readership that they were hearing sort of Eli's bright mind at work. Right, but and I think that's a more sophisticated, I mean, I'm pointing that out, Eli, because whether you agree with it or disagree with it, that's a more sophisticated set of thoughts than I took away from much of that, the foreign affairs piece. So that's my first point. And the second point is about Sudan and Darfur, and it's a great example of why you actually have to work with the UN, crazy making as it is. Now, I totally agree with you. A fundamental problem has been China's willingness to veto anything and China's perception that it could veto anything and pay no price.
Right.
Now, then you have to ask yourself, why did China perceive that it could pay no price until very recently? And that answer has to do with a Bush administration, not just a Bush administration, mind you, by the way, that the Europeans have also been pretty shameful on on this, but that has been quite willing to talk the talk at home and assure the, you know, thousands of student demonstrators that, that they were doing everything they could, but in point of fact, to not really make a very big deal about it at the UN and to allow, you know, negotiations for peacekeeping to drag on for months and months to make the absolute minimal commitment of what we would contribute in exactly the logistics and lift category to help get more troops to the region, to sort of make it clear, you know, when you send that kind of body language that, okay, if this takes another 6 months, it's not a real big deal for us. And then that in turn sends a veto, to a signal to the Chinese, oh, okay, we can veto this one again and it won't be that big a deal. And that is how you come to have this, you know, woefully undermanned, under-equipped, under-trained AU force that now splinter rebel groups are overrunning and killing to pick off more weapons. So that's now actually becoming part of the problem. And yes, moral responsibility ultimately lies with China and with Russia and the other countries that are so intent on protecting their own sovereignty that they don't care what happens to the Darfuris.
Right.
But another tier of countries, which includes the U.S., countries that really like to think of ourselves as human rights defenders, chose not to make this much of a priority. And that, again, that's not the fault of the UN as an institution. That's the fault of the decision makers who chose not to try to use the UN very hard.
Well, I mean, could there have been more? Absolutely. But I mean, and like it goes without saying, you know, America's stretched pretty thin right now trying to prevent a confessional genocide, a competitive genocide in Iraq. So, come on. I mean, it'd be nice if France and other, you know, kind of Western countries could step up on that. But yeah. Absolutely. The U.S. probably could have pledged more and done more. And then I would go one further, that it's sort of a coincidence, but, you know, keep in mind, before Darfur exploded, the U.S. was involved in brokering a peace agreement between the North and the South, which, as a condition of it, the U.S. kind of resumed diplomatic relations with Khartoum and, you know, kind of went through this entire engagement strategy, in addition to, obviously, the U.S. has, you know, thought it had a good kind of counterterrorism agreement with the Sudanese intelligence service, which I hear now is not as good as we originally thought it was. Surprise. But, you know, this is a great transition.
It did actually bring an end to the mass killing in the South, and you have
it did.
Actually
No, that it, absolutely it did. Yeah.
So it's a great example of how that actually worked, and, you know, full credit to the Bush administration for pushing on it, for picking up what the Clinton administration had been doing, for working with folks on the ground.
The Clinton administration wasn't actually working towards Susan Rice was, you know, pretty against the Khartoum regime. It's one of the few things that Susan Rice did. I'm a human rights red meat kind of guy. So I like that when Susan Rice said, "There's slavery here." Remember that speech?
Oh, I do. anyway, I'm sorry. You were trying to transition to something.
Well, yeah, and this is actually a point that you came up with new rules for supporting nonviolent aspiring regime changers. And by which we mean
I did.
This, well, I mean, I meant you know, the street protesters who sadly have been beaten back in Rangoon, and sort of the civil society groups, and I think that, you know, I just want to say that here's how the transition works here. You mentioned, you know, ultimately probably the reason why Russia and China protect so many tinpot, you know, autocratic torture states as they do, is because they don't want there to be an international system that would ultimately kind of squeeze them for their kind of authoritarian policies as well. And so the best hope, as I see it, for the long run for our security and for the sort of spread of liberal democracies, which I'm sure that we both agree, is to sort of see the success for these, you know, these velvet revolutions and these people power movements. So with that, why don't you talk about your post for the Democracy's Arsenal on Burma?
Well, there's a funny thing that's happened, you know, in recent years, is that my kind of progressive in particular has really been turned off the whole idea of democracy promotion because of the rhetoric of the Bush administration and because of the sort of failures it has wrought in Iraq and the Middle East. And so you have this really frustrating, to those of us who are old-time human rights and democracy folks, backlash that you, and I can hear the commentators revving up already, that you go to conferences and people say, well, why would we ever want to support democracy? That's terrible. It's imperialist. It's horrible. It's all about our imposing ourselves through military force.
Supporting democracy, just forget the invasions part, right?
Right.
Supporting democracy is imperial. It's the opposite of imperial, right?
Yeah, but the point is that it's a fascinating, you know, sort of unintended consequence that the whole construct has become so tainted in the minds of many Americans on the one hand, but also, by the way, in the minds of the people we were trying to help. So, you know, one of the things that happened is that a couple of years ago you had these wonderful, really courageous civic movements in Ukraine and Georgia, the Orange Revolution and the Rose Revolution, which led to the expulsion of really crony-filled post-Soviet governments and the installation in Georgia of a really incredible government, and in Ukraine of a government that's had, you know, more than its share of struggles
the good
and difficulties.
Guys just won, though.
Yes, but the good guys did just win, and you know, that frankly, it's, you know, Nobody is poisoning government officials anymore in Ukraine. So there was real progress. And in both cases, U.S. government money had been engaged for a long time, both sort of officially through AID and through non-governmental organizations that get a lot of money from the government, like the National Democratic Institute, the International Republican Institute, groups that do democracy building, that do it on the ground in a mostly kind of low-key, long-term way. But the Bush administration couldn't resist jumping up and down and claiming credit. And that put the new governments of Georgia and Ukraine in a very difficult position, and it gave Moscow another stick to beat them with, and really it kind of damaged their credibility in really harmful ways. And so my comment was, you look at what went on in Burma over the last 2 weeks, and you see, you know, that is a place I was looking up. Aung San Suu Kyi has been under detention for most of the last 20 years. That's a place that has been in a very bad state for a very long time. To have any thought of any kind of civic protest, you have to, it just takes incredible courage.
Yes.
Because, you know, I mean, there's not really any illusion about what's going to happen to you. And yet, you know, people did it anyway. You know, you saw the monasteries as an organizing center, and then you saw ordinary people just coming out and saying, no, this is an institution of our civic life that we're not going to let you assault. I saw some really nice reporting about Muslims and Christians coming out to support the monks as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really a kind of a profound statement about how the people conceive of themselves. And so the first point I wanted to make is, like, this is what democracy building really looks like. And on the one hand, there are a lot of Americans, both in government and in nonprofits, who work very hard to try to help the Burmese democracy movements in any way they can. Those ways are very limited because Burma is such a closed society. And so, and obviously because anyone who seems to be getting any kind of help from the U.S. is in extreme jeopardy. So it's a classic situation where everybody is aware of what's going on, you know, would like to see the Burmese regime punished, would like to see movement toward a real transition, but there are no kind of satisfying, easy, either, you know, you can't use military force, you can't exactly airdrop ballots or copies of the Constitution into the country, you can't easily, there's no, you know, TV Rangoon, you can't write grants. So it's the classic, this is the face of democracy promotion. It takes a damn long time. It's very frustrating. Sometimes you feel like you're getting nowhere. And the primary ingredient needed for its success is the courage and resourcefulness and values of the folks who live in the place.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything you just said. B, there are a lot of neoconservatives who have been saying for a long time with regards to Iran that they'd like to see some kind of any help to the civic resistance organizations and other places like that. There is a tradition of Republicans and conservatives, especially under Reagan, supporting these kinds of initiatives. And I also agree with you that you have to be very delicate with regards to sort of what you admit publicly about what you're doing and what you just sort of, you know, for the sake of protecting the people you were trying to help from a policy perspective, don't admit publicly. And I just want to point out that, you know, the successful case of the first of these sort of new Velvet Revolutions was in Serbia, and I remember that right before the election, Slobodan Milosevic got on television and started calling out poor Dan Serwer for, you know, well, you remember this? I mean,
I do. You know, Dan Serwer is my cousin by marriage, so I remember it very well.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm just saying that I remember that, and then thinking to myself, you know, every single time the dictator is going to try to blame this, as they're going to try to say that the genuine resistance movement in his own country is really the long arm of some, you know, imperial power. That is a typical tactic, and I just think that they're going to do this sort of thing, whether we like it or not. And there has to be, you know, I mean, one of the great things, I don't know if you know the Center for Nonviolent Conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I love them. And they are trying to develop strategies that anybody could use in these sorts of things. And they've got a video game that they've worked on. They're doing these documentaries. And so I have a lot of faith in that. I think that ultimately you're right. And I just want to stress, it's not a program or a policy from Washington or the European Union that's going to make this stuff happen. It's going to be the courage, the pluck, the determination, and the skill of the opposition, and it's going to be the errors of the regime. It's a contest for power, and then we should never sort of forget that. But that said, it doesn't mean that we can't do things to support them, and there needs to be. I always think that, you know, the biggest problem now is there needs to be a very good non-political, like not right or left, but just if you care about human rights, because it is so important, if not just human rights, if you care about spreading liberal democracies, which is so important, then we have to have a better way of communicating with these leaders and in these countries, so that when they ask for what kind of help we can give them, that would be good. And we should have more non-government institutions. I mean, I'll just say this. I think that it's the era of liberation acts is over. Like, I don't support, I don't want there to be a Syria Liberation Act. Like, I don't think there should be an Iran Liberation Act. There shouldn't be, like, it's not for the State Department to do, and the State Department will end up, you know, ultimately trying to control something if they're trying to coordinate it. I'm not saying they aren't skilled, but, I mean, it's just, this has got to be something that's going to be organic, and I'd much rather see the ACLU, the AFL-CIO, I'm sorry, the AFL-CIO and other kind of, you know, just foundations in America and on Europe, you know, supporting these groups and doing it, you know, very quietly. But that ultimately, I think, will be the way that in the long run we win.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a danger, actually, that foundations, which have always provided a lot of the support, you know, for this, was always non-governmental,
yeah,
that there's a real danger that they'll walk away from doing it because it seems so tainted by the failures of the last 6 years. You know, Tom Carruthers at Carnegie.
I'm aware of that argument.
Yeah, Tom Carruthers at Carnegie has actually written a really, really good monograph about sort of how to decontaminate democracy promotion, he calls it. Democracy Promotion During and After Bush is the name of the piece. And he,
by the way, we haven't heard, by the way, the full side of the other side of the story from the democracy promoters. I mean, I'm just saying that I've started to do those interviews. I'm skeptical of their case. I'm just saying, like, you know, before we sort of render the judgment of history, we should know.
Oh, what is this? What is Blogging Heads TV for if not to render the judgment of history?
I render this a failure. Bush.
Well, on that note, should we say goodbye to our fans?
Yes. And listen, we disagree, commentators, and I'm not talking to all of you, but there is a fringe of you. I just want to just point out, okay, if you hate me that much, and I'm talking like four of you, okay? Don't watch. Anyway. Go put on the one with the Al Jazeera guy and Bob Wright, okay?
Well, Eli, I'm waiting for you to invite me to blog with you on some much more conservative forum, and then we can compare the hate mail that I get there.
I don't know that there is such a thing, but I've got a campaign out. We're going to see more and more conservative commenters.
Okay,
slowly
great.
But surely.
Well,
good talking to you.
Fun to do this. You too.
Okay,
bye-bye.